meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda. After you register, you will receive a Zoom login link providing access to the meeting. If you're here in person and wish to speak, you may register online or with the assistance from our colleague at the registration table outside. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you. Please unmute yourself so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room waiting to speak, you'll be called by name. Please come to the podium so that we can best see and hear you. All speakers have 3 minutes for commentary. Please state your name and affiliate organization, if applicable, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. And I'd like to ask Julie House, our clerk, to call the roll.
Good morning. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger. Can we bring Board Member Kissinger up on the screen? Vice Chair Young.
Here.
And Chair Hacker.
Here, thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting, and we welcome everyone. The second item on our agenda is public forum. I will now open our meeting to the public forum, which is for items that are not on the agenda today, that are not a pending or an impending matter, meaning they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Julie Haas, seated here in the front of the auditorium, if you have any questions. I'll call on each of our public speakers who have registered to speak under the public forum portion. If you are remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform. That way we will know to call on you. Again, each speaker is allowed 3 minutes. Thank you for your understanding and participation. Julie, who is our first registrant?
We have no public registrations. We do have a Jessica Fox on the line, so I'm not sure if she's here to speak at the forum or not.
Let's ask. Ms. Fox, are you here to speak in public forum? No? No, Wes? No? No, they're there? Very well. Ms. Fox, if you had intended to comment, and we have somehow been ships passing in the night, would you be so kind as to send us an email? So there are no other Zoom participants waiting to speak. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to speak during public forum? Seeing none, let's move along. The public forum is now closed. Item 3, we will tackle the minutes of our most recent board meeting on September 10th. Let's review the meeting minutes included in our board package and posted online as a draft. Are there any edits or revisions to the minutes? Seeing none, I'd like to ask for a motion and a second to adopt the September board meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Board Member Batty and seconded by Board Member Ransom. Julie, would you call the vote, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger. Aye. Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
I have to abstain as I was unexpectedly absent. Do we have a clearer view of Board Member Kissinger? Is that working out?
I'm working on that right now, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Bill, it's just a bit muffled when we hear your voice. Right. Item 4, board members and executive officer reports. I'd like to hear from board members, and then we will have our executive officer's report, but as we usually do, we'd like to welcome Sean McGuire, our State Water Resources Control Board member, for some brief updates via our Zoom platform. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Chair Hacker, board members. Good to see you virtually here. I am happy to be here to provide a quick update for you this morning. Two things I wanted to cover briefly. One is the Bay Delta plan and some evolving matters there. And secondly, is a quick review at the water year that we just passed and the water year that we expect to come. Hopefully you can see me on the screen. I see a
Yes. We can see both your slides and you and Bill Castillo.
Okay, good. I have a different view here. All right. So with regard to the Bay Delta plan, when I was at your board meeting in person last month, we were anticipating hosting some hearings on the Bay Delta plan update, actually at the end of September. For those who are tracking, you're probably well aware now that those hearings were canceled. We rescinded that notice and provided a brief update publicly that a revised version of the Bay Delta plan document, which we released the draft, updated draft in July. So another revised version will be released now and anticipated in December this year. And we'll be scheduling another public comment period. And those hearings that were originally scheduled for September will be rescheduled for some time, likely early in the new year. So a lot of moving parts. It's a very complicated, challenging water quality control plan update, as I'm sure you're aware. There's a lot riding on this. It's been long, long in the development. And I'm very hopeful, though, that we're coming into a place where we'll be able to make a decision sometime next year. So that's the big update there. The other piece I wanted to cover for you is, I think, the presentation you see on the screen now, the water year in review and looking ahead. I had a very comprehensive update provided to me yesterday at my State Water Resources Control Board meeting. We had about, a 2.5-hour information item on this very topic. I'm going to distill that down for you, for all of our benefits, to a Cliff Notes rapid-fire summary version. And part of this is in request of Board Member Batty. I think at the last meeting, you asked for a crystal ball look at what's ahead. And spoiler alert, we don't know. But nonetheless, I'm going to show you the slides that were presented to me just so we can all have the same context in terms of where we are today and what we might have to look forward to. So if you can go to the next slide, please. All right. So I think good news here. It's like this is kind of a good news, bad news. When you look at the water year that was, we had actually above average precipitation in Northern California, but we had one of the third driest year on record in far Southern California, south of Santa Barbara. So the implications of quite a bit of our water supply, of course, comes from Northern California. But there are certainly impacts felt, and you know, these kinds of extremes. We live in a state of hydrologic extremes. We live in a Mediterranean climate. It's always been that way. We're sort of at the mercy of Mother Nature. It's not always all that predictable. And this year, this is just how things fell out. So the good news is this set us up okay. So we're not back in a drought statewide, but certainly the dry conditions in the southern part of the state are concerning. Next slide. So this just quickly is a chart showing essentially the same thing. So these are the stations in Northern California, the 8 station index. For the rivers, Sacramento River, Feather River, and others that feed the State Water Project and Central Valley Project that supply much of the state. So we're above average, which is great, 106% of average. Always good to see. We want to always be above that blue, that light blue shaded area if we can, which is the average. Next slide, please. This is going a little farther south. So this includes a lot of the Bay Area supply. You see Hetch Hetchy on there. So the Tuolumne River supply, we were at 82% of average for that part of the watershed, which is not too bad. Next slide, please. So, and then the farthest south that we have here is the Tulare Lake Basin. And again, 86% of average. So looking at the Sacramento-San Joaquin Valley, it's a pretty good report overall for the year. And we were coming off a really good water year in the year prior as well. So definitely have recovered from the most recent drought we saw a couple years ago. Next slide. One of the things I learned about yesterday was, and I think many of us have experienced, I certainly did in Sacramento, was that it was a little bit cooler than average this summer. Certainly we have not, I didn't here in Sacramento see the month-long 100 degree plus heat waves that we've experienced in past years, which is great. I'm very appreciative of that. And you can see up and down the coast, the blue colors here and some inland show areas where it's been a little bit cooler than average, than the mean this year, which has been helpful, I think, in managing water use and just keeping evaporation down. Next slide, please. And that's what we end up seeing here is that coming into the water year or the last winter, most of our reservoirs, because the prior year was so wet, were at capacity or near capacity this year. And so where we're at today, as we start the new water year on October 1st, is in really good positions from a surface storage perspective statewide. You can see here there's some green lines, if you can see them. They say historic average. And the blue bars are where storage currently is at each of the major reservoirs. And by and large, they're all right around historic average, which is a good place to be coming into the next wet season, which hopefully we'll be able to find ways to recapture that available storage and be in a good position for next year. Next slide. And quickly, this is a bit of a side note, but we're, of course, our water supply, it comes from surface water sources, but also groundwater is a key piece to this. And we could spend a long time talking about groundwater supplies and how diverse they are around the state. But I just wanted to show this to you a bit as well. It tends to be when we have good water years, groundwater levels tend to stabilize as well. I think a lot of times that means that's because a lot of these areas have both surface water and groundwater available to them, and they tend to rely on the surface water when it's available, a little cheaper, easier to access, and then pivot to groundwater supplies when surface water is lower in availability. So if you click one more time, please. So this shows kind of the one-year groundwater level change, which you can look at later at your leisure. And then over the last 10 years, you can see the in the middle chart there, the red areas in the Tulare Lake area in the far south there, the areas that have seen the most overdraft, which comes as no surprise. We know that those are the critically overdrafted areas. That's why you see the red dots there. And then as well as some areas in the Sacramento River area. And you can also see some dots around San Francisco in the East Bay area there as well. Next slide. And so there's just an abundance of data that Department of Water Resources provides, and they're getting more and more as these the monitoring programs from the groundwater sustainability agencies come into play. There's, I think, something like 9,000 monitoring wells, monitoring groundwater levels now in the state. So we're getting a really robust record and picture of what's happening in terms of groundwater levels and what some of those trends look like. So not a lot we can glean from here other than we're just getting a very good picture, closer and closer to real time understanding of how hydrology and pumping operations and different management decisions are influencing groundwater sustainability issues and the storage and the water supply certainty that comes with those as well. Next slide. And this is just more of a kind of, if you're interested, one of the big challenges with groundwater overpumping is that it causes the ground to sink in some areas. It causes subsidence. And we're using different data sources. I think this uses remote sensing to show how much the ground has, in a year-to-year basis, vertically goes down. And actually, in some cases, goes up. We saw this in the last couple of water years because of the robust precipitation. We've actually seen some uplift which was new to me. I didn't realize that could actually happen. But that's, I guess, encouraging that there's ways, and I think there have been a lot of management actions to help try to slow down the subsidence that's been occurring. But also Mother Nature can come in and give us a hand every now and then as well to help stop and alleviate some of those conditions. It still causes we've seen large infrastructure impacts, particularly to the California Aqueduct for the State Water Project that supplies Southern California, but also some of the other major irrigation canals and other water supply sources. So it's something we're all focused on and working diligently to try and slow down and stop the subsidence as soon as possible. Next slide. Still on groundwater, this just shows what happens when we're in droughts. So on the left, you can see that bar chart, you can see the number of dry wells, usually small domestic dry wells, or wells that went dry, that weren't dry before the drought, but they experienced that. And then the green bars in the middle there, around 21 and 22, is the peaks that we saw during the last drought. So this past year has been really good, fairly minimal complaints in terms of community members experiencing dry wells. So that's a positive sign. Next slide, please. And almost to my crystal ball part of this presentation, but the last thing I wanted to just share with you is how we're doing when it comes to urban water use. So this shows the statewide potable urban water supply production that's reported to us from urban retail water suppliers around the state. So this accounts for most of the urban municipal water use around the state by far. And the good news here is that we're doing pretty well as it compares to other recent water years, that our water use has gone down as compared to those years. So we're heading in the right direction there. Of course, some of that might be because we did see the cooler year overall in most of the urban areas. So that might have helped tamp water use down a little bit during the hot season. Next slide. So the rest of these slides were presented to me yesterday by Michael Anderson, who's the chief hydrologist and climatologist for the state of California, but he works for Department of Water Resources. So I'm just passing along some of this information that was shared with me. And that here the slide, what it shows is, you know, we're entering into a La Nina year, and what we're seeing here is that red blob next to between the United States and Asia. It was pointed out to me that it's an extremely unusual heat anomaly in the ocean that we're seeing, and it's not exactly clear how that will influence precipitation patterns and high pressure systems and such as they'll develop. But certainly, it's something to keep an eye on because it could absolutely trigger drying conditions in the western part of the United States. Next slide. This was just the water year. This is another way to show how dry it was in Southern California relative to Northern California. So I think we can move on to the next slide, please. This was pointed out to me, and I thought it was interesting. All the red arrows in the top left chart show the atmospheric rivers that hit the Western United States last year. And that's really that's the gravy train of water. We're dependent on these kind of episodic atmospheric rivers hitting and bringing large bursts of precipitation and hopefully snow. And what you can see here is they all hit is essentially north of Monterey, and nothing hit in Southern California south of there. So that tells the story about why Southern California was so dry and Northern California was above average. Next slide. Again, this is just a way to show the significance of how that those high pressure systems and the way the water temperatures and the jet stream form over these next couple of months are really going to make or break our water year. And we're really going to, it's really this November, December, January timeframe where we'll really have a stronger sense for what the water year is going to result in for us. Next slide. All right, this is the big reveal. And as usually happens with NOAA forecasts at this time of the year, they're not entirely enlightening. But on the left here, we've got our October to December 2025 temperature forecast, which is for warmer than average conditions in California. And then on the right, you see the seasonal precipitation outlook, which is equal chances above normal to below normal. So I don't mean to interpret this in any sense, but basically they don't know. So they are predicting wetter than average conditions in Washington and Oregon. And notably here, you do see below average outlook in the Southwest, which is where the Colorado River is, which is another key water supply for Southern California. So that does add a significant level of concern when we're looking at statewide water supply challenges. Next slide. And this is the last slide I have, which is which is kind of the crystal ball a little bit farther out. So this is January through March 2026. And they are predicting drier, warmer than average temperatures in Southern California and drying conditions from a precipitation basis in the lower half of the state as well. So again, this is the best available information that we have at the moment. Certainly, I've experienced in my time on the board here in the last 7 years, many of these predictions evolving in other ways, unexpected ways. So we always have to be prepared for one extreme versus the other. And that's what I took away from my presentation that I received yesterday and wanted to share with you. So happy to take any questions, but that's all I had for today.
Thank you so much. And thank you for co-hosting Eileen and me at our regional board chairs and executive officer meeting last Friday in Sacramento. Let me look to see if my colleagues have any commentary for Sean, Jane.
I do. Sean, first of all, thank you so much. That was a great report, even though it's perhaps a bit inconclusive. But yes. I had a question about, are the slides that you presented or the information, how is that shared? I'm thinking in the agricultural community, but more widely, how do you share this information? How does the State Board share this information?
Well, like I said, these were presentations provided to us. But I know that Department of Water Resources does a public press conference and release of this type of information at the beginning of the water year. So I think just recently they shared essentially the same type of data. It's on their website as well. So I think you can go find it there. And I'm certainly happy to share anything that you'd like.
If you could share the slides, maybe via Eileen or something, that would be...
Yeah.
Really great. I know in Half Moon Bay, there's lots of interest in what it's going to be like this winter. A lot of different activities going on down there right now. So thank you, Sean.
You bet.
Any questions for Sean?
Yeah, Sean, thanks so much for this. I wanted to ask you, and if you don't know the answer to this, maybe we can revisit it at some point in the future, but the whole perspective that you're sharing with us, comparing this water year and the next water year to historical averages, for me begs a question of that somehow implies that historical averages still have relevance for us. And so, for example, like the precipitation data. It's my understanding that more precipitation is falling as rain instead of snow, and I didn't appear that's captured in the presentation you were giving, the data sets. I don't know if the State Board and just in a broader context, can you say anything about how the State Board is considering how we should look at our water years given the fact that we know that the historical baseline is shifting?
Absolutely great point. Front of mind, for sure. And I think when we're thinking about the likelihood of our future resulting in more flashier systems, so wetter, so hotter conditions, and stronger rain, storms coming in as rainfall and less snowpack, we need to figure out ways to prepare for that and take advantage of the benefits of that, which is an abundance of water supply just in a short, coming in a shorter window. So looking at things like groundwater recharge and different ways of capturing that water and storing it when we can't, when it's available, are things we have to get ready for. I think the governor's water supply strategy, also known as the hotter, drier strategy, predicts some of that, those shifts in climate patterns coming up in future decades. So we need to be prepared for that. Yeah. And I will say that I'll come back again later. So in subsequent months here, as we hopefully start to get some snow, I get a report on snowpack and how we're trending there. So I'll provide an update and right. let you know how that's looking.
Right. I mean, I thought the hotter, drier strategy is fantastic because it really paints that future. The question I'm asking, though, and I know I don't really have an answer to it, is so we look at you look at the data you presented us, and you said, well, we're close to historic averages, so that's, you know, that's great. But I think that doesn't capture for us the how much more variability we have in the future, and therefore it's not maybe as great as it looks. And I'm not saying that there's, you need to answer this now, but it would seem to me that we would be well served to develop some type of normalizing or statistical approach that captures for us that just because we're close to the historic average doesn't mean that we're not going to face some challenges because of these physical changes that we know are coming. It's more like how do we capture that in these assessments of where we're at the end of the water year? And I would be really interested to hear from state board staff over the coming year or so, just if people are thinking about how to present this in a way that captures that for the public and for public decision makers.
Yeah, there has been a lot of work there thinking about climate change uncertainty and modeling, mm-hmm. and happy to come back with some more information for you on that.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
Sean, I had one question for you, if you guys can hear me.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the unusually warm temperature of the ocean between Asia and California, or the West Coast. And I'm curious, you suggested that would likely or could lead to drier conditions. I would think it would be the opposite. Is it understood what those temperatures will do? It seems to me the warmer temperature would be more evaporation and therefore maybe more precipitation. But is it understood that, in fact, no, it would lead to drier conditions?
And this is where I'm not a climatologist, so I probably should watch my lane a little bit. But my understanding from the presentation I heard yesterday was that it could result in a more defined high pressure ridge and push the jet stream up and have it stick kind of north, much farther north of California. And so we wouldn't get those atmospheric rivers then as much, and that would be the challenge. So,
got it. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. That was so interesting, and we look forward to having access to those slides and seeing what this winter will bring. I'd like to turn to board member reports and then our executive officer's report. Jane?
First of all, I just want to assure Sean that over the next couple of weeks, I will check in with a very small grocery store in Carmel Valley where the farmers go and get their and the ranch managers go and get their breakfast burritos, because last year they were all abuzz and the year before about what it was going to do, and they were right when no one else was talking about it. So I'll keep you posted on that, what they have to say. I have just a couple of things that I want to share. One is that tomorrow I have the great opportunity to attend the Climate Summit for San Mateo County. This is the fourth one they are holding. I just want to read you this to you real quickly. This is put on by Nuestra Casa, the Climate Resilient Communities Rise South City and Thrive Alliance, which is an alliance of nonprofits in the county. Our vision is that every person in San Mateo County and beyond breathes clean air, drinks clean water, lives in a healthy home, and is part of a disaster-resilient community in which their voice matters. The summit is a venue for pushing policy change, cross-sector partnerships, and power shifting necessary to achieve this vision. The event is sold out. They're going to live stream it, but people are there's a wait list, or people are really trying to be in the room. I'll share more after the event, but I think it just really speaks to the passion of our local communities to continue to address all the issues around sea level rise and climate change, particularly in communities where they may not have the voice that they need to have, that are most impacted. Which brings me to the last thing I will just check in on is just to say that the water issues in Pescadero, while there are some solutions underway, continue to be a real situation for the community and community members. I'm waiting to get a little bit more information and specifics, and then we'll be circling back with Eileen and Sean, who were so kind about reaching out to see how we can help. But Pescadero is definitely on my mind as we head into another water season. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane. Vice Chair Young.
Thank you. Just a quick one. I will be attending a conference in November called the Data Center Dynamics Conference, and I've actually been invited to be on a panel to have a conversation about public and private partnerships. And while data centers may not actually really drive a lot of what we do here, the public-private partnership part of it is important because it's our opportunity to encourage data centers to not only take into account water quality, but also water availability. And it will be an interesting conversation because, of course, it's the power of money versus water, but it is an opportunity for us to be out there. And while I may not be representing the water board in its full capacity, I will be there in that capacity, and hopefully I can come back with some positive impact or some positive comments from some of the data center companies. But that's it. Thank you.
It'll be interesting to hear from you. Board Member Kissinger.
I think for me, but I'm interested, when is that, what's the date of that Data Center Dynamics program?
November 3rd and 4th, I believe.
Thank you very much. Great, thanks.
Anything else, Bill?
Nothing further from me.
Yeah. Go.
Yeah, well, it was great to hear Jane read that, such a promising statement. I'm going to have to talk about things that were much less promising. I think it's really important. I assume almost everybody here knows, but since I have this microphone once a month, it's important to remember that the President of the United States stood before the entire world and said, quote, that climate change impacts are the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, close quote. And as absurd as these statements might seem to many of us, they have a real impact. And I hope that people will push back against this. I did yesterday, speaking about climate change to the Sons in Retirement in San Rafael, and I remind my colleagues here that I'm available to give public presentations about climate change in our communities. Of course, Svante Arrhenius calculated in 1896 what a doubling of carbon dioxide due to the temperature of the Earth, and I guess maybe the president would say that was the beginning of the hoax. This is such preposterous leadership, and it is not just him. Our Secretary of Energy just called the Paris Agreement silly, and that, you know, you wouldn't know about climate change if it wasn't in the news. This was just after the Chinese government had to evacuate 1 million people ahead of Super Typhoon Ragasa. Secretary of Interior called Concern About Climate Change an Ideology. While he is touring Europe trying to sell more American fossil fuels. I find these statements to be not just dangerous, but very counterproductive for what we're trying to do in our region. And I have been asking all the elected officials I work with and others about whether in their day-to-day work they're finding people who hold this kind of denialist framework about what's happening to the climate. And the answer is no. I don't find any evidence of that in our region. Which is good news, because we're all going to have to work together in a reality-based effort to make our region more resilient, just as the people who are sponsoring that event in San Mateo are talking about. So I encourage all of us to take every opportunity we have to make sure that we point out that the science behind the climate change is real. We've understood it for 150 years, and we, despite what I consider the juvenile obstinance of our president, that we have to plan for these real things happening. Thank you.
Thank you. I will go last. I wanted to just recap quickly three things. Last Friday, our executive officer and I joined the other 8 regional board chairs and executive officers from all 9 boards with our state board members and some of their staff to go through what is a semi-annual meeting that we have together in Sacramento. And we talked about budget, and we talked about policy and some recent legal decisions. And we had a very welcome, up-to-date presentation on PFAS, looking statewide, from a couple of people who did, at the end of a Friday afternoon, they did a really, really good job looking at the data of recent years from public water systems and how to focus our attention and resources. Even though there were elements of the chemistry of it all that may not easily translate into broad public understanding, I thought they did a superb job bringing up our collective level of knowledge about where to focus our efforts statewide. So I'm hopeful that that presentation might end up on our website, even though it is much better with their narrative, but it was wonderful. I missed the last board meeting, but just prior to that, Xavier Fernandez and I, on September 5th, had attended the San Francisco Bay regional focus of the One Water effort that is underway to try to increase water recycling and water reuse in the Bay Area. It was a really worthwhile day-long series of discussions from people from all different parts of our regional world here who have an interest in what are the barriers and opportunities to increase recycling and reuse. Excellent materials and more to come from them. And coming up, do you want to mention the RMP coming up shortly? And I will leave it at that. The Regional Monitoring Program Conference in Berkeley is coming up, and we look forward to attending. So let me turn to our executive officer.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Hacker and members of the board. First, I'd like to share the good news that Governor Newsom has reappointed board member Mark Ransom to the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. We're very excited to continue to work with you, Mark, and appreciate your engagement. At our August meeting, I shared with you details on the Environmental Program Manager position, which is funded through the U.S. EPA San Francisco Bay Restoration Program to support nutrient management in the Bay. We received a grant for $3.8 million to fund 2 new positions over 6 years. Staff in these positions will work with clean water agencies to reduce nutrient discharges to the Bay and update guidelines and policies to facilitate beneficial reuse of soil and sediment to restore and conserve wetlands. The first position I shared with you was filled internally by Dr. Kevin Lundy, who shares the nutrient management strategy and will be leading the preparation of the non-TMDL basin plan amendment to allow more time for certain qualifying projects to reduce nutrients in San Francisco Bay. I'm happy to share with you the second position, which is funded by EPA, has been filled by a talented engineer and geologist, Alex Snyder, who will be working with restoration petitioners, flood control agencies, dredgers, and other interested parties to identify policy and guidance revisions that will facilitate the beneficial reuse of soil and sediment to conserve resilient baylands. And now from the Executive Officer Report this month, we share details on the San Francisco Bay PCB Total Maximum Daily Load, also referred to as TMDL, and its upcoming revision. This work highlights the critical role of collaboration and adaptive management in addressing legacy pollutants. Originally, this TMDL was adopted in 2010, and it aimed to reduce PCB concentrations in fish tissue to protect human and ecological health. Despite efforts to reduce external PCB loads, especially from urban stormwater, the largest source, fish tissue concentrations remain significantly above target levels. This limited progress, even after 15 years of implementation, underscores the need to reassess and refine the original strategy. Through collaborative efforts among the San Francisco Water Board, San Francisco Estuary Institute, the Regional Monitoring Program PCB Workgroup, and the Bay Area Municipal Stormwater Collaborative, a new understanding has emerged targeting PCB reductions in highly contaminated nearshore areas, or priority margin units, which offers the most promising path forward. These partnerships have enabled the development of detailed conceptual models, synthesis of updated data, and joint fact-finding to inform a revised implementation strategy. The upcoming TMDL revision will maintain the original numeric targets, but shift the focus toward these priority areas, supported by updating modeling and monitoring. This collaborative, science-driven approach exemplifies how adaptive strategies and stakeholder engagement can accelerate environmental recovery and improve long-term outcomes. And I want to acknowledge Setney, who leads this effort for the Water Board. And then next, I'd like to share some good news, our successful conclusion of one of our cases in the Toxics Cleanup Division. The San Francisco Bay Water Board has determined that no further remediation is needed for the groundwater plume at the former Kim Central facility in Hayward. The site, which operated from 1965 to 2009, had a history of chemical storage and handling that led to significant contamination of soil, soil vapor, and groundwater. Investigations of the site began in 1989. And cleanup efforts, including a treatment system installed under a 2000 cleanup order, successfully removed over 11,000 pounds of volatile organic compounds before the system was shut down in 2016. Since then, monitoring has shown no rebound in contamination levels. The Water Board is now working with a responsible party to revise the monitoring program, reducing groundwater sampling to once a year and adding yearly soil vapor sampling, while also evaluating options to address residual soil vapor impacts. I want to note that the case manager, Helen Hill, who's in the audience today, was only a baby when this site first was identified as an investigation. So this case illustrates that the cleanup of these sites takes several decades and are multi-generational. And finally, in the October report, we shared with you that the City of San Jose hosted us to show the city's commitment and progress to reduce homeless encampments and control trash along its waterways in accordance with the municipal regional permit. We were given a tour of a new emergency housing site that offers shelter and services until interim housing is available. Then they provided us a tour of an interim supportive housing project that was constructed in partnership with Valley Water, which will house over 130 people and offer supportive services when it opens later this month. The field visit provided an excellent opportunity for us to see firsthand how San Jose is implementing its direct discharge control plan to control trash within 26 miles of their waterways. With a human-centered approach, to manage and end unsheltered homelessness and control trash. By touring reaches of Coyote Creek and Guadalupe River, we got to see firsthand San Jose's work to control the direct discharge of trash into creeks. San Jose is leading the way through its extensive internal efforts and collaboration with many private and public partners, such as Caltrans and Valley Water. San Jose is dedicated to working with the unhoused with respect and dignity, and they have seized the opportunity to improve the lives of those struggling to find housing by providing housing and support services while controlling trash to improve water quality. We were very impressed by their level of commitment, the results they proudly shared, and their collaborative approach. They have set the bar for other municipalities to replicate in the Bay Area. Last but not least, we have put at the dais copies of the tentative board calendar for 2026. We'll publish the calendar in December for the public and our third-party partners. This concludes my highlights for the October board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. There may be board commentary. Jane.
I just have a question, Eileen. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, I am familiar with San Jose's efforts. It's amazing. They're doing incredible work. But I want to try to understand the MRP and the 100% compliance requirement and how, when communities are doing so much, but the issue is always evolving, how do they get to 100%? Or, yeah, can you just talk a little bit about the compliance side of this?
Yeah, so the others who did not do the direct discharge plans have until the end of this year. So we will get the report from San Jose how they, if they really met the target or not, at the end of this year. The others you'll hear about in December, when we're going to update the board on the other municipalities who did not do direct discharge plans. They were required to meet that requirement at the end of June. Those reports have come in, staff are looking at them, and we're going to report on those at the December board meeting. And I think part of sharing San Jose, and I think one of the reasons they want to host it, I'm not sure they're actually going to meet it, but the point is they have spent over $100 million. They have taken a multi-pronged approach. On that Thursday, when we had lunch with them, we were there with the police chief. We were there with the mayor. We were there with the environmental program manager, with the Department of Parks and Recs. They had their top executive management, and they told us they meet every Thursday at lunchtime to see how they're doing it. When we went out to look at the areas where the encampments were, there was a dozen police officers with us. They like to stay in the background, but as needed. They have the social services people. When they took us to the interim housing, you saw that the people get three meals a day. There's showers there. There's the sanitation services. There's the social services. So they're really doing a remarkable job. But they're going to need more funding. They want to talk to our board chair. And it's a very complex issue. The other problem is they're doing such a good job that people are giving homeless bus tickets to San Jose. So the problem is just exponentially growing for them. But they have done a remarkable job taking a very humane approach. We saw along the creeks and waterways where they, you know, gave people 90 days notice. They kept going back in and saying, okay, now we're down to 60 days, 30 days. Then when they went in and relocated people to interim housing, then they cleaned up the waterways, and now there's signs that you can't come back. And if they come back, now they don't get 90 days warning. They took us to these houses. It's amazing what they're doing, but it's very complex to deal with. We're very impressed with their multi-pronged approach, treating people as human beings, but they need more services. So to answer your question, we're going to acknowledge people's progress. Whether they've actually hit their target or not, it's a different story. It's a huge issue. It's growing, and they're just doing a phenomenal job, and it was great to have them share with us all that they're doing. And so we're going to take that all into consideration.
That's great. I'm really pleased to hear that. I think it is a very complicated issue, and I applaud San Jose. They are well-resourced. It's so great that they can do this, but I know that efforts, to the extent they can, are happening across the Bay in smaller communities, even in Half Moon Bay. There's extensive efforts going on, but the ability to really get to 100%, I hope that will be talking about all the mitigating factors so in December. So thank you, Eileen.
Thank you.
Yeah, Eileen, I really appreciate the detail. This is a little bit longer executive office report, and I found it to be a real page turner. I really appreciate it. The I just want to reiterate, I think, what Jane was saying, that this is a hugely complex issue. And I'm not convinced that the water quality impacts of homeless encampments are the biggest challenge to our communities. And I want us to be thoughtful in how we approach this. I still remember from the MRP hearing the one of the fire departments from one of the communities saying that we put out porta potties and they're on fire in 48 hours. This is just a really, really difficult issue, and it does, in my mind, make a 100% compliance target a little tone deaf. But I look forward to hearing about this, and I hope that there are ways. Maybe we could help build a regional forum so that the things that San Jose is doing that are working can be exported to other communities regionally. Although I acknowledge, as Jay noted, that not every community has the resources that San Jose has. On the other note, on the PCB TMDL, now, I don't want to take a lot of time if you guys are going to come back and talk to us about this marginal watershed approach. I'm completely fascinated by this and could nerdify on it for an hour. Are we going to hear about this?
Yes, you'll hear more about it. That was kind of an appetizer, just to, obviously sparked your interest.
All right. Well, it definitely worked. You got my attention. Okay.
You may need a special early briefing with Seth and I and Xavier.
Yeah. If we do a briefing, then the board doesn't have to hear me ever on about it. Okay.
Well, it is very fascinating, and it shows kind of once again how you don't have results overnight. You know, here we're 15 years in, but what I think is really impressive is that the team has realized, okay, we had good science, good information, adopted the TMDL, but what have we learned? And so now we're going to adjust and adapt, and by focusing on certain areas. So I think it is really of interest.
I think it's of broad interest, and we have many of our community organizations in the Bay Area that are interested in this as well. So,
I'm also just interested by this because if we're focusing on these locations that have peak concentrations in the watersheds that have a lot of source, we have a much better chance of seeing the impact of our activities than if we're looking at the average regional concentration of PCBs in mussels in the RMB or something like that.
Right. That's exciting. Board Member Kissinger, anything at this moment?
Nothing for me. Sorry. I'm unable to unmute myself.
Thank you, Bill. And I just wanted to thank the City of San Jose, Mayor Mahan. I'm so glad that Eileen and Keith and Rebecca and Imtiaz Ali could go and spend a very long day understanding many different strategies pulled together. I've heard the mayor on the radio quite extensively. He's extraordinary in being able to pull together these disparate elements that are making a difference. So I'm so glad that you could do this, and it will inform our discussion later this year about this challenging part of our work. Anything further, Eileen?
No, thank you, and I won't be as long in the future, but since some of our items had gotten pulled from the board agenda, I figured I'd take the time to dive a little deeper this month.
I'm glad, and I look forward one day to when we can get back to issuing permits. Are we ready for item 5?
Yes, great. So this item is the presentation of the 2025 Dr. Tin Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award to an agency in recognition of its exemplary pollution prevention public outreach and education campaign. DeAndre Alejandra, who goes by DJ, was a scientific aide working in the MPDS division for the Water Board up until a week ago, until he was promoted to an environmental scientist in the MPDS division. So I want to congratulate him. And this will be his first presentation to the board, and he is going to provide a presentation on the 2025 Dr. Tin Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award. Following the presentation, we'll take photos of the chair presenting the award outside the auditorium here in the hallway and take a short break. So with that, DJ, it's all yours.
Thank you so much. Good morning, members of the board, and to all those that are attending virtually or here in the audience, of course. My name is DeAndre, like Eileen was saying, and I may be an unfamiliar face as I was promoted to be an environmental scientist for the NPDES division just last week. Thanks, James, for the job and then immediately throwing me in the deep end. While I might be wearing a new figurative hat, my work previously as a scientific aide with the pollution prevention team has been nothing short of inspiring, and it is my privilege today to be given the opportunity to present on and announce the recipient of the 2025 Dr. Tang Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award. Before the presentation of this award, let's talk briefly about pollution prevention, what it is, and its significance for us here at the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. As someone who works in wastewater regulation, this is one of my favorite quotes from the California Water Code, if I can direct your attention to the screen. And it says, the legislature finds and declares that pollution prevention should be the first step in a hierarchy for reducing pollution and managing wastes, and to achieve environmental stewardship for society. Pollution prevention is acknowledged in California legislature as a vital component for achieving the foundational goals of the Porter Cologne Water Quality Control Act. As a regional water board, we mirror those same sentiments, as we believe that pollution prevention is a key component of pollution source control for protecting, enhancing, and restoring our region's water resources. The process of pollution prevention, also known generally as P2, is what we call it in our team, can be generalized into three simplified steps. And the first step, what's important, is identifying our pollutants of concern and, of course, where they come from. Mercury, household hazardous waste, fats, oils, and greases, also known colloquially as fog, to name a few, are some of the more common pollutants that's targeted in pollution prevention activities. And then secondly, agencies or even individuals can create a pollution prevention plan or a collection of practicable and repeatable source control projects to minimize the generation of pollutants from their primary source that was identified in step number one. And then, of course, last step, number three, those plans are set into motion by implementing the source control measures in their pollution prevention plan to reduce, or even in the best success stories, even eliminate pollutants before they enter our sewer shed. These source control measures have manifested into a myriad of different efforts like site inspections where specific pollutants are generated, establishing collections or drop-off sites for household hazardous waste, organizing words or letters to lawmakers to advocate for EPR, extended producer responsibility, advocating for a proper signage for disposing of certain hazardous products, or most importantly, public outreach with the intent on creating awareness on the impacts of these pollutants on our waterways, the sewer infrastructure in fog, for example, or on the natural world. Since the 1980s, we at the Regional Water Board have made pollution prevention a priority. Our pollution prevention program was started by the late and great NPDES Division Chief Dr. Tang Chung Wu, the namesake of our Pollution Prevention Award. He was an early advocate of source control, who believed that it's better to eliminate pollutants at their source rather than relying and maybe even investing on expensive wastewater treatment technologies. And under his direction, we began to include pollution prevention program requirements in NPDES permits for all municipal wastewater agencies. These agencies satisfy their programmatic requirements by administering their own individual, specialized, and sometimes innovative pollution prevention programs. And we have been recognizing excellence in pollution prevention through this award for almost 20 years. 20 years is actually going to be next year. During those years, we have recognized both individuals and agencies who have captured the essence of Dr. Wu's legacy. While it's not the only form of pollution prevention, we have recognized a number of public outreach programs because it is so important to educate the public on pollution prevention concepts to change simple, everyday behaviors to implement source control, even on the individual level, like spreading awareness not to flush your medications down the toilet or proper disposal of certain household chemicals. However, changing human behavior is difficult. It can be very hard. It's easy for people to choose the convenience of disposing harmful chemicals down the drain, where it's out of sight and out of mind, where they don't know the true environmental consequences of their actions. Such behaviors can become generational, developing into a pesky old habit, and we all know that some old habits are difficult to break. I had some ice cream at 2 a.m. last night. This is why public outreach continues to be a major and consistent component of pollution prevention programs. Even more important, though, is to direct these pollution prevention concepts towards our youth in particular, which can inspire responsible pollution prevention practices in younger generations that can develop into lifetimes of habit. And of course, with those sentiments in mind, it is my honor to present the 2025 Pollution Prevention Award to Union Sanitary District for its excellence in pollution prevention outreach to youth. This morning, I'm going to highlight the district's school outreach program, a robust educational program that reaches kids in the cities of Fremont, Union City, and Newark, also known as the Tri-Cities area, teaching them pollution prevention concepts in the context of their watershed, how they impact their watershed and watershed stewardship to round it out. For the past 30 years, the district has been delivering pollution prevention-themed lessons that have reached more than 52,000 students, which is a pretty staggering number. The school outreach program is free, accessible to fifth graders in any school in the Tri-Cities area. Last year, the school outreach program reached 88 classrooms and continues to connect students to their watershed through a variety of lessons and hands-on learning activities. The lessons pertain to both wastewater and stormwater, both of which we know are pathways that can transport harmful pollutants into their watershed unless the sources of those pollutants are controlled or at least mitigated. For example, the lessons describe how water passes through their urban landscapes, including the district's wastewater treatment plant, and then back out into the natural world, reinforcing to kids that the water that they use comes from the very same environment they are themselves responsible for protecting. To aid in these lessons, you can see them in front of your board. The district provides placemats highlighting different water paths in human society, such as untreated wastewater traveling to the treatment plant, for example, from the students' homes, and then, of course, treated wastewater traveling back out into the environment after treatment. The placemats also highlight stormwater and how rainwater travels straight to the environment without any treatment at all, often picking up or mobilizing pollutants on its way to a downstream body of water. The district also discusses the ways they can help protect sewer infrastructure, such as don't treat toilets like their personal trash cans, and keeping fats, oils, and greases, fog once again, out of the drain. The placemats also show different ways students can help prevent water pollution and direct them to resources such as the local household hazardous waste facility and collection sites. The district lets kids take home those placemats. You get to take those home too. And encourages students to share the newly learned pollution prevention concepts and various disposal directories with their parents so that they can tackle the pollution prevention problem together as a family. Teachers get something out of this too, maybe even a free afternoon if the presentation goes that long, perhaps. But most importantly, a teacher workbook that helps them incorporate additional water learning activities into their everyday curriculum. On the board is a picture of all of those giveaways. You can see the other side of the placemat at the top, which helps drive home the message of water and its various pathways. The school outreach program also includes a variety of hands-on activities that simulate how pollutants mobilize and spread into waterways. For example, kids use food coloring as mock pollutants to observe how easily those pollutants spread into the water. You can see on the right-hand side, water pollutants, the food coloring of the graduated cylinder. On the left-hand side is crumpled up paper, with the crumples in the paper resembling water bodies like streams or rivers. And as kids place water at the high points of the paper, the water travels through those crumples via gravity, often picking up the food coloring, or again, those pollutants as it travels to the bottom of the paper or the representative downstream body of water. This facilitates a conversation about how even a small amount of pollution can have a large impact on water resources and the environment, and that cleaning up pollution downstream is often much more difficult and expensive than controlling it upstream at its source. The school outreach program also meets Next Generation Science Standards, also known as NGSS, a set of science education standards that aims to prepare students for science and technology careers in the future. By encouraging key connections that are made between themselves, human society, urban activities, and the Earth systems around them. And last but not least, last year, Union Sanitary District recently piloted a summer program called the Junior Ranger Summer Day Camp and includes many of the same watershed and pollution prevention concepts in its school outreach program, but it also includes some other fun activities too, like a walking trip, a walking survey to the kids' local Mission Creek, introducing how pathways of water are formed, and most importantly, how campers can contribute to its conservation. The district delivered 6 of those pilot programs last summer, and they are excited and hopeful to continue this series and expand their pollution prevention deliverables to kids all year round. Union Sanitary District's school outreach program, once again, is an important avenue to inspire youth towards a lifetime of pollution prevention, fostering the necessary practices now and hopefully for many years to come. Did I mention that the school outreach program is led not by a cavalry of people, but just by 2 people? And I was actually just informed it's mostly by 1 individual. This impressive effort deserves to be celebrated, and it deserves to be recognized. And we are pleased to award this year's Dr. Tang Chung Wu Award to Union Sanitary District. Can you please join me in celebrating USD with a round of applause? And I will now invite the 2 stars behind the program, Alicia Dutrow and Alex Paradis, to accept the award, and if they want, the floor is theirs to say a few words.
Thank you. Congratulations. We would love to have you say a few words.
Good morning, Board Chair. Good morning, Board members. My name is Alex Paredes. I'm the Environmental Compliance Supervisor for Union Sanitary District. And with me is the star of the show, Alicia Dutrow. She is our Environmental Outreach Representative, and she's the reason why we're here. On behalf of Union Sanitary District, I would like to thank the San Francisco Regional Bay Water Control Board for giving us the opportunity to share our school outreach pollution prevention program and for considering us for the Dr. Tang Chung Wu Pollution Prevention Award.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much. We really appreciate the recognition. Not that we do it for the recognition, but it is a lot of work, and we appreciate being acknowledged for it. It is amazing to me. You know, I spend a lot of time in these fifth grade classrooms, and a lot of these students are very aware of just the critical state of our environment and water resources, and they are very interested. They are very engaged. They love our presentation, so it is really valuable work, and hopefully they carry that stewardship message with them forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'd like to take a 2-minute break just to take a few quick photos outside, and then we'll resume our meeting. Thank you. Thank you, guys. All right, we're going to turn to item 6, which has the fascinating name of the Site Cleanup Subaccount Program, which definitely, like TMDLs, needs a new brand. But the topic itself is worthwhile, and I'm looking forward to hearing about this grant program for cleanups. Eileen.
Great. Yeah, our site cleanup team is going to provide an overview of the Site Cleanup Subaccount Program, which, as you noted, Chair Hacker has referred to as SCAP, not the best name. But we have our great team here. Ron Golobo, who's Senior Engineering Geologist on the Toxic Cleanup Division, will begin by providing background on the Site Cleanup Subaccount Program. Then Jacob T. Henry, engineer and geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division, will summarize the key components of the program. And then Catherine Ward, engineer and geologist in the Toxic Cleanup Division, will provide a case study in West Oakland. And now I'm going to turn it over to Ron. Go ahead, Ron.
All right. Good morning. Thank you, Eileen, for that introduction. So we're here to talk about the site cleanup subaccount program. And I'm going to provide the overview, and then Jacob and Catherine are going to tell you how it's working in our region. So I guess, spoiler alert, it's working well. we refer to this as the SCAP program because, you know, the site cleanup subaccount program just doesn't quite roll off your tongue. So it's a grant program, and it's intended to provide funding to responsible parties that own contaminated properties in disadvantaged communities, and they lack the financial resources to conduct this work. So again, it's property owners, disadvantaged communities, and no money. Funding's short. As it turns out, many of these property owners are former dry cleaners. So let's get into it here. Okay, overview. So when Senate Bill 445 passed in 2014, it created a subaccount by transferring $17 million from the Underground Storage Tank Fund into this grant program. And so since 2021, fiscal year 2021-25, the program has been funded at $34 million a year, and that's where it stands for, what, the last four fiscal years. So that's a good thing. Of course, we could always use more money. In the beginning, regional board staff collaborated with the state board to promote this program and to evaluate and prioritize applications. So the word got out, basically it was myself and some other staff working with the supervisor. We would review site data and collaborate with the state board on a monthly basis, trying to promote cases or applications in our region. So as you can imagine, after the stakeholders found out about this program, many more applications were submitted, and the state board had to standardize the evaluation process and prioritize these applications to approve the grant. So that's what Jacob's going to touch on. It's kind of like a bit of a scorecard situation. So let's see. Now I'm going to this one. All right. Okay, so here's a little, some stats or numbers. Over the past 10 years, 443 applications have been submitted. Now, this is on a statewide basis. We've got to remember this is a statewide program, not just for our region. We've got 443 applications, and these are for cases overseen by regional board staff or offices, not including local agencies or DTSC, the other state agencies that might oversee a project like this. And the grants have ranged from roughly $85,000 to $3.2 million. So it's going quite nice here. But now, so you can see kind of how this has evolved over time, and I'm going to turn it over to Jacob, who's going to tell us more about the SCAP funding in our region, the ranking methodology scorecard, as I like to call it, eligibility requirements, and some other funding mechanisms.
Thank you, Ron. Jacob?
Thank you, Ron. Our region has had a total of 75 responsible parties apply for grants since 2015. Over that time, 22 sites have received grants, with 12 sites currently funded with active ongoing investigation and remediation. In fiscal year 24-25, our region received additional grant funding for 5 sites, which means the site grant was extended to continue the environmental work. Otherwise, no new grants were issued in our region in fiscal year 24-25. State Board manages the money to ensure it is spent efficiently. Scoring for a new grant is a two-step process that relies on the assessment of the environmental risk and whether a site is in a disadvantaged or an environmental justice community. Points are assigned and tallied to generate a score that is used to rank a site. First, I will walk us through the scoring for environmental risk, which considers impacts to groundwater, soil vapor, and indoor air, and if there are impacts to drinking water and sensitive receptors, for example, a school. The key to scoring is the number of contaminants exceeding applicable environmental screening levels and the order of magnitude of those exceedances. Groundwater and soil vapor contamination can receive a maximum of 15 points together, and indoor air contamination can receive 5 points. Lastly, a total of 4 points can be awarded if a drinking supply well or sensitive receptor is near groundwater and/or soil vapor contamination. For disadvantaged and environmental justice communities, sites receive points based on the economic status of their location. A site is either in a disadvantaged or severely disadvantaged community, which is based upon a comparison of the median household income for a census block group with the statewide median household income. Disadvantaged and severely disadvantaged communities are those in which the median household income is less than 80% or 60% of the state median household income, respectively. Sites in disadvantaged communities receive 6 points, and sites in severely disadvantaged communities receive 12 points. Sites also receive points if located in an environmental justice community. The CalEnviro screen percentile score is used, which calculates a score based on exposure to and environmental effects of existing pollution and whether there are sensitive populations and socioeconomic factors that need to be considered. A CalEnviro screen percentile score greater than 75% receives 12 points. There are 3 main steps to obtaining eligibility for a SCAP grant. The first and most critical step is a directive issued by a regulatory agency. This directive can be from our region, the Department of Toxic Substances Control, or other local oversight programs. For example, the Alameda County Department of Environmental Health. The second step is employing the ranking methodology to determine a score. A site will either rank as eligible for a grant in the current fiscal year, eligible for a grant in a future fiscal year, or not eligible. Not being eligible for a grant is due to a low score. The final step is determining a responsible party's ability to pay, which requires a review of the responsible party's financial situation, which is completed by the State Board with support from the assigned case manager in our region. If eligible, a site receives a grant based on their position on the grant list. The DTSC's Equitable Community Revitalization Grants were available to public agencies and nonprofit organizations that were responsible for environmentally impacted sites that were planned for affordable housing. Our region provides regulatory oversight for 6 of 15 still active grant sites. The program funding was not continued in 2025 due to state budget limitations. Another available funding source is the U.S. EPA Brownfields Assessment Grants for cleanup at sites where reuse, redevelopment, and expansion may be complicated by contamination. These grants are still actively being issued. Now, Catherine will walk us through a site that has received a SCAP grant and the current status of the cleanup efforts.
Thank you, Jacob. Former ABC Dry Cleaners in West Oakland received a SCAP grant for $1.7 million in 2023 for the investigation and cleanup of tetrachloroethane. This chemical is common in dry cleaning operations and is often referred to as PCE. The site was a priority to receive a SCAP grant because of the high concentrations of PCE in soil vapor and groundwater. The location in a disadvantaged community that also has a high pollution burden, and the proximity to a local high school. The site was approved for a SCAP grant before the ranking criteria was established, but if it was ranked with the other applicants, it would have received 31 points out of a possible 46 points. 13 of those points are for the human health and environmental risk, 6 points for the location in a disadvantaged community, and 12 points for a Cal Enviro screen in the 80th percentile. Drilling investigations found high levels of PCE in groundwater and soil vapor beneath the former dry cleaner and off-site. The photo on the left shows one of the drilling investigations at the site. Indoor air was tested in the former dry cleaner building, and it was found that vapor intrusion is occurring in both the first floor vacant space and the second floor occupied apartment. It was unexpected to find PCE in indoor air at such a high level in the second story apartment. The pathway for vapor intrusion into the second story was investigated, and they found bare dirt under the subfloor of the stairwell, as you can see in the photo on the right. Vapor intrusion investigations are complex with many different factors, and it is extremely challenging to pinpoint a direct pathway. So it was really great that they were able to identify the direct pathway into the second story residence. With the pathway identified and the high levels of PCE in indoor air, short-term mitigation measures were needed to reduce the vapor intrusion. Vapor intrusion mitigation measures such as indoor air filters, concrete patching, and a vapor barrier installation were completed to reduce the PCE in indoor air as a short-term solution while the soil vapor cleanup is underway. This chart shows PCE concentrations in indoor air over time. The indoor air results in blue are for the first floor unit, and the orange is for the second floor unit. The chart shows that the mitigation measures reduced PCE in indoor air by over 3 orders of magnitude. The PCE in indoor air is still above the screening levels, but it has significantly dropped, and the cleanup work has started to remove the PCE in soil vapor. As the cleanup work continues, the indoor air concentrations should continue to decrease. The SCAP grant is funding the cleanup of soil, soil vapor, and groundwater impacted with PCE. A soil vapor extraction system was installed and will operate for the remainder of the SCAP grant. This is a system that removes PCE in soil and soil vapor. The picture shows conveyance piping connected to a box in soil and soil vapor at the site. To treat groundwater, a dechlorination mixture was injected into the subsurface to break down the PCE in groundwater. The picture on the right shows the casing that the material is pumped through into the subsurface. Additional injection events are planned, and the performance of the soil vapor extraction and groundwater injections will be monitored. The SCAP grant has allowed this important work to move forward without delays, and it is helping to clean up contamination in a disadvantaged community. The reality is that there are many other responsible parties in our region that lack the financial resources to investigate and clean up their sites. There is a need for more SCAP funding or other grant programs for responsible parties that do not have the ability to pay for cleanup work. This concludes our presentation, and we can take any questions about the SCAP program. Thank you.
Thank you to the team. There may be questions. I'll start with one. To what extent does the SCAP program deal with orphan sites? Or is there always an applicant who can engage the engineering and other technical expertise with the grant? Ron?
Yeah, there is an orphan program through the state board. Our region does not have any currently. It is a program, I understand, that you engage with the owner and the responsible party. You make sure there's no ability to pay, and then you would ultimately lien the property for the state would put a lien on the property for the work that gets done. We don't have any in our region, though. The other regions apparently do.
And so in this situation, the example you gave of the dry cleaners in West Oakland, did the grant go to the property owner who engaged the engineering and technical expertise?
Well, it's a combination where the state board, the owner does come with the consultant with the plan, and then the plan gets reworked or revised through the state board of what they'll fund. And then it's for ABC Dry Cleaners, for instance, it's a very prescriptive scope. So if you find differing conditions, you have to try to adjust the scope or the budget. There's a certain parameters, you know, a certain 15%, I think, of what can be adjusted throughout the life of the project. They come to the program and then or come into the application. And then many times when people find out they have to go through this ability of pay analysis, they walk away because they don't want people looking at their finances, or they think, you know, they just don't want to do it. So it's been interesting dealing with all these different parties. It's very different every case.
Right. Questions? Andy?
Were the residents of the second floor of this building experiencing any kind of respiratory or other medical distress? Were they aware that there was something wrong?
Not that we're aware of. We did meet, we did our section meeting. We went to the site for a site visit. They were doing some work, so the five of us showed up there and got a tour, and we met the resident. Also a guy named Ron. He'd been there. He's from Oakland, very proud Oakland native. And he had a child in the upstairs, but unaware until, you know, the case manager, Madeline Gall, reached out to him and to let him know what's happening. And, you know, in this particular instance was very appreciative to know, because the landlord was not engaging or telling him anything. And so that's kind of our job, is to send out these fact sheets and knock on doors. So no, he did not know. We're not aware of any health. I mean, these are long-term exposures. He has been living there, I forget how many years, but it's not a short period of time. And it was good to get that. It felt good to get those numbers down. The system seemed to be working. So
this level that was three orders of magnitude above the ESL or whatever, this was still a level that would be associated with chronic effects, not acute effects?
Correct, the long-term effects.
Yeah, okay. So it seems to me about three or four times a year we have some sort of presentation, some sort of discussion about an abandoned dry cleaner. How many of these sites do we think exist in Region 2?
Oof.
Are there so many, make any sense to count them?
It's hard, you know, because these dry cleaners are small spaces,
right,
and then they turn over, and then, you never know until somebody goes to redevelop a site and does a phase one book study and then come to us. We have, you know, when SB 445 started in, 2014, we had an initiative where we were reaching out to dry cleaners in the region and issuing site history reports, and then those would become, you know, we would say, oh, this was a dry cleaner for so many years, or this, you know, we evaluated, I would say, hundreds of them and got a few into the program, into just cost recovery, where they were paying and going as the as a standard site. But there are, you know, literally hundreds of them that are unaccounted for, or, and I'm speculating here, but it's my sense from looking at this, it's, we just don't know, and they're out there. So,
and is there any way, I'm not familiar with the legislation you just referenced, but are there ways that the state can hold this entire industry more accountable for the problems that have been created? I mean, obviously not every dry cleaner site is, I assume not every dry cleaning site looks like this one.
Correct. Yeah. No,
okay. So that there, but is there, it seems to be this sort of like, you know, operate a business in a dirty fashion and then wash your, you know, kind of wipe your hands and walk away. This seems like it's just going to be a constant source of problems for residents who happen to end up, or businesses who happen to end up, you know, with the property in their hands, right? This is the problem of whoever is the legal owner of the land. It's not the problem of the business that operated there previously.
It's a combination, but I would defer to my attorney for some of this.
But before you go there, I mean, think of at the state and federal level, there are laws and regulations in place to deal with releases of hazardous substances into the environment such as this. But the universe statewide of, for example, a sector like dry cleaners, and think of how many of them would have closed and gone away during COVID, never to return. But for decades, that's been uninventoried and have gone away. And if we were to embark on a risk-based prioritization, kind of like you have with the grant program, you have sort of criteria, it's a fraction. I would imagine we're not getting at 1% of the universe.
Okay, well, it's so great having you around, Alexis, because you have answer all these questions. That's kind of where I was going with this, is this is, the work is, it's really impressive to see, and I love to see the analysis after treatment to show, you know, that we know what we're doing, right? We can mitigate these issues, but if we're only touching 1% of the problems, and I keep coming back to the guys from Marinwood, who, I mean, we haven't heard from them in a couple months, but I know they'll be back. We're not solving the problem, and at least getting ourselves aware, right? I mean, we could run the SCAT. Do we have to run the SCAT program for 100 years to clean up every site, or can we do it in 10 years, or are we never going to get there? I mean, I would be interested in understanding this, you know, the scale of the problem that has, you know, basically been kind of dropped in our lap.
Yeah, it's the money. You know, if we had more than $34 million, we would have more cases.
But do we know where all the sites are?
No,
we don't.
We don't know where all the sites are, but we don't even have enough funding for the sites we have. So if we could double,
well, that's
triple,
always the case, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so right. So, and I do want to give credit, actually, big credit to Ron and Madeline, who's a case manager. When they first got the results, they notified the resident right away, knowing that you did not wait on that when you got those high results. So I just want to acknowledge public health is a big deal. And since there was not every case, is there somebody living you know, and it's going to be impacted.
Well, I remember the issue with McClymonds High School, and that wasn't a dry cleaner, but I recognize that. I'm not criticizing the work you guys are doing. I'm very proud to be associated with this. It's the scale, the actual scale of the issue that it seems to me, all we know is that it's enormous, but we don't know how big it is. And granted, there isn't residential uses associated with every one of these sites. But I would love to see us try and get our arms around this issue to at least know how big a problem this is, and if we don't get more resources, how long will it actually take to deal with this? Because I have a bad feeling about this, to quote Luke Skywalker, that it's going to take a long time to go site by site with the current resources.
Well, in 2014, when the SB 445 came into place, you know, we were going through business report, or like yellow pages, and looking for addresses and dry cleaners, and you know, going back in time and trying to, then you try to find the current landowner, and they don't know what the heck you're talking about, and so it's quite a process that way. And then also the Santa Clara Valley Water District, the Valley Water, had a large study put out where they also implicated many dry cleaners and pointed us to dry cleaners in Silicon Valley, Santa Clara County, that we followed up on those as well. So it's a staffing issue. It's a finance. It's the whole, you know, confluence of issues that we're dealing with. You know, if somebody goes to develop a property near a dry cleaner and they find this contamination, then we hearken back and do some sleuthing trying to find the dry cleaner, and lo and behold, it's a property that's been handed down to, you know, the daughter or the children of the other people, and they don't know anything about it, and you know, so it's kind of a problem. But yeah, it keeps a lot of people busy in our office. I know that.
It's more than just a data issue around the inventory of what's out there. Let's just start with this region. I mean, we don't have an inventory for historical purposes. We don't have the PY to cover a region-wide effort or to lead, and we don't have the dollars to get out there to willing grantees. So I think it of necessity becomes one of willing participants who apply and a higher risk situation. I dare say that most of what we have has not been investigated at the, you know, at the neighborhood level. Think of all the small neighborhood dry cleaners that closed. But I didn't give Yuri and Chech an opportunity to add to this discussion, if you wish.
Sure. I'll just add that Ron is correct, and that we do hold the current landowner responsible for any ongoing contamination of PCE that's migrating through the soil and groundwater. And we try to reach the original operator, but that in many cases that's difficult because these are very historical operations and you know, that have long ceased operations. So it's very difficult.
Are we confident that current dry cleaners aren't creating a similar problem for future regional water board staff?
I would say as they operate today, the PCE is no longer included in their treatment system or in their cleaning system. Apparently worked pretty good, but it created this mess. And so, yeah, I think we're confident it's not a current problem, but many of the dry cleaners that are at the existing or the former location, you know, are just, it's the same location. So, but no, I would say that since PCE is taken out of the service, it's
and the current chemicals being used by dry cleaners, if they leaked into the ground, would not cause a similar problem as PCE. They're not as long lived, or
go ahead.
I would just say, you know, we're learning more about PFAS. PFAS are in everything. They're probably, when you take your suit to the dry cleaners, probably has PFAS. So I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but I think for that particular contaminant, which was a contaminant of big concern, yes, we're dealing with it. As you know, we have the whole RMP, contaminants of emerging concern, and PFAS is a big one. So, but PFAS is everywhere. So I don't want to say that dry cleaners aren't causing any pollution, because the rug here, I'm sure, is full of PFAS. So I just want to, you know, but I want to give credit to the team, who I think does such great work with a finite amount of dollars they have, and the prioritization really does focus on the highest priority sites. And one of the reasons with Valley Water is because they rely on groundwater. At least here in our area, we're generally not using groundwater, but we get concerned about public health. So, and it'd be great if we had more PYs, and it'd be great if we had a lot more funding, but at least we're using it as wisely as we can, and kudos to the great team.
Yeah, well, that the thing I took away from my orientation as a water board member several years ago was how we have to prioritize our approach, and then we prioritize the prioritized approach, and then we prioritize that, and then maybe we have the resources to deal with the third level prioritization. So I understand that. I guess I just am a little sensitive to this idea that we're being, you know, I think we need to remain humble about the scale of the problem relative to what we are doing. I would certainly not suggest we don't do anything because we can't do it all, but it's, I think, part of our mission, to be true to our mission, we not only need to clean up these priority sites, but we need to point out that there are, you know, we're at this point, our professional judgment, as I can see, is that we're just scratching the surface. And I think that's something that you know, we need to be, I think it's part of our public outreach efforts or our strategic plan or whatever, is to acknowledge that, you know, we're doing this and we'll probably still be doing it in the next century.
Got it. Okay, Jane?
I just wanted to say thank you, and I particularly really appreciated your presentation. The materials and how you presented was really great. So thank you, and applaud the work. Thanks.
Thanks. What I'd like to do is go to public comments, if there are any. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to make comment? Is there anyone online?
No registrations. Online.
I wonder if there was ever, Ron, a professional organization of dry cleaners that kept a little handwritten list.
Well, I mean, I would be remiss if, you know, I did, working with Kimberly West, we, you know, big PFAS advocate. There are studies out there that dry cleaners are a source of PFAS into the environment.
Yeah.
But we haven't. We're trying to get the PCE at this point, and we'll.
I had a slightly different thought was, I wonder what AI might turn up for you if you made a query.
Okay. I'm going to call this item to a close since we have no comments, and thank you to the team for your stimulating presentation. Very well. Item 7, long-term flood protection plans for nearshore landfills and industrial facilities. This is something the board has taken up earlier, and we're looking forward to this update.
Great. So Alex Karpowitz, an engineer and geologist on the Toxics Division, is going to provide the presentation. And just to remind the board and the public that long-term flood protection plans were submitted for 27 nearshore landfills and industrial facilities to comply with general waste discharge requirements adopted by the board in February of 2024. So Alex is here to give you the update. Thank you so much, Alex.
Yeah, thanks, Eileen, and good morning, members of the board. Like Eileen said, in January 2024, you adopted amended waste discharge requirements for nearshore landfills and industrial facilities requiring long-term flood protection plans. So as a reminder, we've issued two of these amended orders. The first one was issued in 2022 for 16 Bayfront landfills, shown in the figure on the left. that required alignment of long-term flood protection reporting requirements across all these facilities and considered groundwater rise for the first time. In 2024, we amended orders for 27 bayfront and oceanfront landfills and industrial facilities, shown in the figure on the right. The 2024 amended waste discharge requirements required 7 tasks to identify strategies for the long-term protection of a site from flooding and inundation due to sea level rise, groundwater rise, and extreme weather events. I'm going to focus on just a few here, starting with task 1, which requires dischargers to use most current climate science to evaluate their sites. The amended order referenced the Ocean Protection Council 2018 sea level rise guidance, medium, high, and extreme risk aversion sea level rise scenarios. At the time the amended order was adopted, the 2018 guidance was the most current state climate science guidance document available. However, in May 2024, the guidance was updated and new sea level rise scenarios were projected. As you can see, the projections were refined to narrower expected ranges than those presented in 2018. And the extreme, or H++ scenario, is no longer expected to come to fruition. Staff provided responsible parties with notice that updated guidance was available and should be referenced, specifically the intermediate and intermediate high sea level rise scenarios. Task 2 required planning for protection of the site, taking into consideration the 100-year storm event on top of projected 2050 sea level rise scenarios. The photo on the left is an image from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration during the winter of 2022-2023 that brought over a dozen atmospheric rivers over the span of 4 months. The image on the right is from the Bay Conservation and Development Commission's Adapting to Rising Tides tool, showing what impacts to the Bay Area might look like in the year 2050, assuming a 1 foot rise in sea levels, which is equivalent to the intermediate high scenario projected for that year, with the 100-year storm and king tides factored in. Task 3 requires that vulnerable site features such as levees, groundwater monitoring wells, landfill gas wells, and flares be identified, and the plan must identify how they will be protected from sea level and groundwater rise. Task 4 requires a phased adaptation strategy to protect the site from the year 2100 projected sea level rise, groundwater rise, and extreme storm events. This image of sea level rise adaptation approaches is from the Bay Conservation and Development Commission's adaptation roadmap. And as you can see, it offers a variety of options for adaptation approaches, starting with shoreline protection, such as gray or green levees and seawalls. Another option is accommodation or avoidance of rising sea levels. Retreat has not been an option proposed in any of the plans we've reviewed to date, largely in part due to the exorbitant costs required to relocate shoreline landfills or industrial facilities. So what are some of the findings? Sea level rise and or groundwater rise will impact just about every site by the year 2100, which likely does not come as a surprise to anyone. Some of the vulnerabilities identified in the plans include levee and shoreline stability. As sea levels rise, levees can be overtopped or breached, as seen in this Caltrans photo of Highway 37 in Sonoma. And shoreline stabilization projects, like this riprap seawall at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, can be washed away with combined sea level rise and extreme storm events. Access roads leading into or out of a site may be impacted, in some cases creating islands, like the one shown here on a flooded Highway 99 in South Sacramento. Public access to shoreline trails and roadways may also be cut off by rising sea level and groundwater levels, like this flooded bike trail through Marin. Groundwater, leachate, and landfill gas wells can be impacted. All of these wells can be flooded by rising sea levels and when located along the site's perimeter. In addition, rising groundwater levels can cause emerging conditions of both groundwater and leachate, which at bayfront landfills can be commingled. Landfill gas wells can also be flooded, making gas harder to extract. And in contrast, the waste mass can become more saturated by rising groundwater levels, potentially increasing the amount of gas produced. habitat degradation can occur when wetlands and marsh habitat drown under rising sea levels, which of course can kill plant life and habitat for the species that rely on it, like the light-footed ridgeway rail shown here. The loss of plant life can exacerbate the wave run-up and coastal erosion that sites experience with rising seas and extreme storm events. And finally, landfill cap integrity can be compromised by several factors, including more extreme storm events, waste mass saturation and surfacing of leachate and/or groundwater, and inundation by surface water due to rising sea levels. We've seen a lot of potential vulnerabilities. So what are some of the adaptation measures being proposed to mitigate the effect of sea level and groundwater rise? We saw a range of options proposed from engineering or gray infrastructure, like increasing the height of levees or seawalls, to nature-based or green infrastructure, like enhancing or creating wetland habitat, like the restored Hamilton wetlands in Novato, planting eelgrass, or oyster reefs, like this project at the Point Pinole Regional Park in Richmond. Most responsible parties also recognize the need to work collaboratively with neighboring properties and other relevant regulatory agencies. Most, if not all, cities and counties have come out with their own guidance for climate action planning and resilience, since it's widely recognized that individuals cannot work in a silo to solve future climate vulnerabilities at their sites, since sea level rise, groundwater rise, and extreme storm events do not recognize property boundaries. Let's look at a couple of case studies to highlight plans that stood out for more innovative adaptation planning. Case study one is the Oyster Bay Regional Park in San Leandro, also known as the former Davis Street Sanitary Landfill. To orient you, in the image on the left, this is the Oakland International Airport, and this is Highway 880 running north to south on the right side of the photo. A quick background, the site was built on reclaimed tidal mudflats in the late 1940s. The Dredge Bay mud was used to build a perimeter levee, which you can see in the photo on the right, and waste was placed directly onto the dewatered bay mud. Classic bayfront landfill construction of the time. The landfill stopped receiving waste in 1980 and was closed by 1984. Since that time, the East Bay Regional Park District has maintained the site as a public park. While the site has a maximum topographic elevation of about 85 feet above sea level at the central peak, the perimeter elevation ranges from just 10 to 12 feet above mean sea level. The image on the left is the United States Geologic Survey map showing 6 feet of sea level rise in the area, indicated by the dark blue shading. The image on the right is the Our Coast, Our Future map showing what the groundwater elevations will look like with 6 feet of sea level rise. The color coding indicates blue is marine inundation, red is emerging groundwater, orange indicates very shallow, or 0 to 3 feet below ground surface. Yellow is shallow, with groundwater at 3 to 6 feet below ground surface. And purple, moderate, or 6 to 16 feet below ground surface. As you can see, with no adaptation planning, this site may become an island. Recognizing that the site is subject to the vulnerabilities I talked about earlier, the immediate recommended actions include gathering information from the San Leandro Wastewater Treatment Plant, located immediately north of the site here, on how flooding would impact the plant's ability to continue receiving leachate discharge from the landfill. The surface water drainage system will be surveyed to ensure it's appropriately sized for future extreme storm events. Both the leachate management contingency plan and drainage analysis will be prepared by the next 5-year update. Recommended actions by the year 2050 include additional flood control measures, such as raising the perimeter berm to 18 feet above mean sea level. This action would trigger the need to decommission and replace the groundwater and leachate monitoring well network, as well as perform an assessment of the cap's long-term stability. And finally, in coordination with neighboring stakeholders, a submerged vegetation study is proposed to design a wave action mitigation plan at the landfill and neighboring properties. The responsible parties have demonstrated an understanding of both the timeline of impacts to the site and neighboring properties and the need to complete studies and corresponding mitigation actions collaboratively prior to expected impacts. Case study number two is Shoreline Regional Park in Mountain View. The photograph on the left shows an aerial view of the greater shoreline community in the red dashed outline, which encompasses the shoreline landfill, shown in the green dashed outline in the photo on the right. The landfill is broken into several parcels that make up a 544-acre site, some of which received waste as early as the 1930s. The landfill stopped accepting waste in 1987, and Shoreline Regional Park was established in 1997, including the Shoreline Amphitheater, which is a popular music venue. As you can see in the photo on the left, there are former salt ponds immediately to the north, and Permanente Creek and Stevens Creek run south to north through the site, discharging to the bay. Flood risk for the shoreline community is mainly influenced by these adjacent water bodies. In this image from the United States Geological Survey, 4.9 feet of sea level rise, which is the Ocean Protection Council's intermediate high scenario, is shown on top of the 100-year storm. As you can see, a significant portion of the site will be impacted under this scenario. The projected rise in sea levels prompted the City of Mountain View to develop a sea level rise capital improvement program, as shown in this figure that is much too busy to read, but gives you a sense of how many projects are under consideration to address sea level rise. The program balances the existing and future flood risk management needs of the city and the region. The circled numbers correspond to improvement projects listed in the table below. I'm just going to focus on a few here. And the red box shows the location of the Shoreline Amphitheater for reference. The South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project, highlighted in the yellow boxes, is immediately to the north of the site and will restore former salt ponds A1 and A2W, which are owned by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, to tidal marshes with gently sloped habitat transition zone and reestablish tidal flow connection with the South San Francisco Bay by breaching segments of the outboard levee. It creates future opportunities to connect the restored salt ponds with Stevens Creek Tidal Marsh, Mountain View Tidal Marsh, Charleston Slough, and Shoreline Regional Park to provide tidal marsh and wildlife refuge areas along the shoreline. The shoreline landfill infrastructure, considered as part of this vulnerability assessment, includes the groundwater pumping system, leachate collection system, gas extraction system, stormwater lift station, and the levee along the north edge of the landfill. A plan will be developed to upgrade the aging groundwater, leachate, and gas pumps when needed, with higher capacities and the capability to operate under submersible conditions as a result of the higher groundwater table. The Crittenden Stormwater Lift Station, shown in the yellow box here, is in a low-lying area, which is expected to be inundated with rising sea level and groundwater levels. This lift station serves much of the site, including the amphitheater, fire station, and flare, and will require system improvements to remain operable. In coordination with the city's capital improvement project, the levee, indicated by these two yellow lines, along the northern edge of the landfill will be evaluated for and protected from future sea level rise and coastal erosion that can affect the integrity of the levee. As previously mentioned, the city has been coordinating closely with members of other agencies working on regional efforts that relate to the city's sea level rise adaptation efforts and considers the long-term flood protection plan as part of a living document that will continue to be updated and refined over time so the city can meet the challenges of climate resiliency and adaptation. In the next five-year update, we expect to start seeing some of the proposed adaptation measures and collaborative planning processes being implemented. And with that, I'll leave you with this lovely photo of Muscle Rock in Daly City. And I want to mention that Vic Powell, the case manager for the two case studies I presented, is also here if you have any more site-specific questions, and we're both happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. That was really interesting, I thought, the level of detail in those projects. Bill, you're the most remote. Do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, comment and question. So comment is, you know, looking at Oakland Airport right next door being completely flooded out. I mean, boy, there's going to be a lot of levee building, I guess, in the future. So tell me about the Ocean Protection Council and the change in their advice becoming more focused. And I guess I'll be open. Is there any concern that the work that it's doing is somehow influenced by the skeptical view of this administration on climate change? So let me ask that.
The climate science has been refined based on scientific projections from originally the 2018 guidance was based on 2017 data, and this 2024 guidance is based on 2022 data from the IPCC, Protection. Thank you. Thank you, Andy. I knew you'd know that. So they have refined this data based on more updated climate science, and I don't think it has anything to do with the federal regulations. This guidance was being put together for a number of years prior to this new administration being in place. So I don't think it has anything to do with the current administration.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. I guess... And is there any kind of notion of what the costs are going to be to do the kind of raising of levies to do this work? I mean, it's just massive in scope.
Absolutely. It's going to be pricey for sure. And since you mentioned the Oakland International Airport, there's a Oakland-Alameda Adaptation Planning Committee that specifically works on that as part of the Operational Landscape Unit. That SFPI has recommended that cities and counties work under, so that they are working in coordination with Caltrans and BCDC and a number of agencies to increase the height of the runways and increase the perimeter levee. I see you shaking your head. It's a massive undertaking, but it's one of those vulnerable infrastructure that can't be easily replaced or relocated, so must be protected in place, and it will be.
But presumably the same can be said about SFO. I don't think it's any higher above the water either, right?
It's absolutely going to be another one of the most vulnerable areas that needs to be protected. I believe that planning is already underway for raising the perimeter height of the levee to protect that that airport.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a very helpful, interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Can I just add two things to what is being discussed related to the costs? And it's something that we thought long and hard about, and two nuggets of our orders, our amended orders, we deal with, one of them deals with financial assurance. And we look at the owner-operator of these landfills, and we have them calculate the costs that would be required to address climate change and upgrading wells, moving infrastructure around, building levees. Our order requires them to start this analysis, and so that's a great starting point for them to start thinking about these what could be quite severe costs going forward.
Thank you.
Anything? Go ahead.
So, a couple of things. You showed a slide that said at the bottom, Mountain View, City of Mountain View, Sea Level Rise Capital Improvement Program. That, is incredible. I mean, it just, and the fact that we're thinking about that now in 2025, one of our major cities is already beginning to accumulate capital to make these changes. That's great because it's going to be really expensive. I also think this is a great example of us using our authority to leverage people to think ahead. I mean, this is an important nudge. I hope that these historic landfills don't turn into next century's dry cleaners. With regards to that H++ scenario, and Bill, you picked up on that, I actually have
dug into this a little bit. So the real change was not whether you could have sea level rise of 10 feet, but how quickly it could happen. And it has to do with our lack of understanding of how quickly great ice sheets can collapse. And some more recent thinking suggests that is a process that is rate limited in a certain way. However, having the opportunity to converse with some real leaders in this field, it was pointed out to me that our models are inadequate because, of course, we've never really been able to observe great ice sheets collapsing. And things, for example, like as fresh water leaves the Antarctic continent and flows into the ocean, that changes the nature of what evaporates and what precipitates onto the continent. And the glaciers, of course, are in equilibrium between the melting and the new precipitation. So several scientists that I spoke with feel that we don't know for sure that it couldn't happen. Right now, we're leaning that way. But so I think that, Bill, what we're seeing here is an actual, you know, evolution of guidance based on scientific debate. But I think we need to be aware that the H++ not happening is something we really want to be true. And it's not sure yet that it wouldn't be true. But we'll get more updating over the next 5 to 10 years, I would imagine, as new modeling is done. The last question I had to do with the oyster point, and you know, Bill noted that the map you gave us or the simulation you gave us showed the Oakland airport inundated. Now, I would humbly suggest that we aren't going to let that happen, at least not without a fight. And if we are armoring Oakland Airport, won't that change the relative sea level rise at Oyster Point? Right? So there's, if you have the tide coming in and it can't flow over the Oakland Airport because it's blocked, that's going to tend to keep that water moving towards Oyster Point, and you would get, if I understand the physics of it, you would get an enhanced elevation. And I don't know whether it would be significant for planning purposes or not, but is that something that we've thought about? Because there's all those maps, the USGS stuff just assumes there's no change in defenses, right? That's how they did that. So as we change defenses, we are going to influence adjacent areas. And I don't know whether we really have the capability to look at that now or not, but it's something we should have a little checkbox going forward about, you know, what do you know about what's going to happen nearby? Because that certainly is going to influence it. And I think this is going to be common throughout our region with regards to transportation infrastructure, because we built so much of our infrastructure on the fill, and at least through mid-century, I'm confident we're going to defend it. And that will influence what happens in adjacent places.
Right. And this is part of the collaborative planning effort that we required and that they voluntarily offered to do with the surrounding neighbors, including the Oakland International Airport and Doolittle, which is actually a state highway. So Caltrans is involved in the project as well, right? So they don't become an island out there in the middle of nowhere. And I think the submerged vegetation study that they propose to do is meant to encompass the Oakland International Airport as well. Okay. So some of the mitigation efforts that they're thinking of that aren't just gray infrastructure will help with some of the wave action, mitigating the wave action, slowing everything down before it reaches both of those sites, which are at approximate elevations to each other now at the perimeter, right, the 10 to 12 foot range. So, yeah, right now the projections are showing equal amounts of inundation across that area, but they have agreed to work collaboratively in an operational landscape unit, which is what's recommended by San Francisco Estuary Institute. So I think that the next five-year update will probably shed a little more light on that.
Okay. And this is just, I want to say this is so important. And again, an example of our strategic thinking here. And it will pay enormous dividends in the future to have done this work now. And I'm glad to hear you're getting collaboration. I'm glad to hear people are still thinking at the OLU scale, because I think that's really important to do. And I will look forward, if I'm still on the board, you'll get the next 5 year.
You know, I just wanted to mention, and I am sure there are people in this room that know a lot more than I do about this, but at Pillar Point Harbor, they're doing a demonstration project right now, pilot project. Somebody in here is nodding, where they're looking at beach replenishment right on the edge of Highway 1, because the whole shoreline has been deeply impacted by the levee that was put in by the Army Corps of Engineers 1950s, 40s, 50s, 60s, someplace, long time ago. And so it might be a model of, might be something we want to hear about sometime, about how that work is, you know, what the impacts were and how the pilot work to see how do we resolve it now and balance the interests. It seems pretty interesting what's going on right there. Thanks.
Well, thank you to the team. Last call for any final word. If not, we look forward to your regular updates. Eileen?
Yeah, I wanted to thank the team, and I also wanted to recognize Jessica Watkins, who is the manager of the Groundwater Protection Division, and Vic, who was also the case manager, and of course, Alex, for the great presentation.
Thank you to a good team. Very well. Are there any in the room who wish to comment on this item? And seeing no hands, is there anyone online that wishes to comment?
Nobody online.
Okay. Then we're going to close out that item. And because we have no correspondence and we have no closed session, I'm going to close out this meeting with one advisory comment, which is our next meeting is not in November. It's December 10th here in the auditorium, since we're not meeting next month. And I'm looking forward to that. Thank you all for being here with us today. Thank you to Yuri and Chech, our attorneys, and thank you to the AGP team for making this possible, and to Eileen and all of those who've supported this meeting. We are adjourned. Well.